You're listening to No Dice, No Problem, a new monthly Asians Represent variety show hosted by Drew Kwan and me, Daniel Kwan, on the One Shot Podcast Network. Check out uncut video and other exclusive content at patreon.com/AZNSrepresent. I'm not a dice collector. Like, I love that, like, Kendra, like from our home game made me like a cool themed set for like the main villain, the main antagonists of our campaign.
Yeah.
And I am guilty, not of buying lots of dice, but accumulating lots of dice.
Yeah. Like,
and I just constantly have dice either like sent to me, which I'm super grateful for, but, and I've been trying to like give them away, or because I've been playing RPGs for like over two decades, I've just, amassed dice.
You just end up having more dice. Yeah.
And I have like one of those plastic containers, you know, that you used to store like drill bits and screws and nails and stuff. I have like a massive one just full of dice.
Yeah.
Full of dice. And do I use them? No. I use like, I've actually been using this, if I'm ever rolling physical dice, I have been using the same set that Steve gave me. Steve gave me a set of dice like, 3 years ago, and I've just been using them, and they're like, I like the color. I also have my original like polyhedral dice set.
Oh yeah,
when I first started.
Yeah, like, mine
when I
are
first
somewhere.
Started to still
I have
it.
I know I have. They're mine. Like, I just don't know where.
They're gold. I think I'm missing one of the 3d6s that it came with. I remember where I first got it at the Silver Snail. It's like this comic shop in Toronto. Mm-hmm. It's like one of the most iconic comic shops in Toronto. They've had three locations now, and they get progressively shittier.
Oh, nice.
But the original one was this, Queen Street is like a shopping street in Toronto, in like downtown. And their original one had this beautiful sort of like muraled facade with this old school, like light bulb trimmed Silver Snail Comics light sign. And then you went in and they had these giant statues of superheroes. There was like a whole downstairs area that was just rows and rows of comics and games and wall, like floor to ceiling action figures. And then they had this like upstairs area that you had to go up to. And it was like the games area. So they had, I bought my first like Space Marine there, like a loose Space Marine from a box. They had, it's where they had all their like anime, their manga. They had a whole section on just tabletop games and a little thing on dice. And I remember buying a gold set when I was like really young and saving up for it. And my brother getting this like turquoise set. And I have both of them now because my brother doesn't play games. But do I use them? No, I'm afraid of losing another D6.
Yeah.
Because I've lost one of my three. And I just used that set that Steve gave me in this box I bought on Etsy. But now I think I might have to switch to these new ones.
They're really nice.
They're really nice.
Yeah, they
Kendra
gotta get
also
use.
Made a set for Emma as well.
Hell yeah!
But do I collect dice?
Nah.
No, I'm not gonna go to the store. Actually, it's funny enough. We went to a store called Black Knight Games in Hamilton, and Emma and Kendra, who we've mentioned on the podcast, but for context, Kendra is not Asian. Is our white friend who's in our D&D. And Kendra and Emma both bought like teeny tiny polyhedral dice sets just to use. And it's like, oh, that's
like,
cool.
Like the really small ones?
Like the really small ones. And I think
Kendra can't stand them.
Wants to use them as to make a mold for her own dice.
Okay.
And I think Emma just liked them. But I don't remember the last time I actually bought dice.
Yeah, same. I just don't care. Like I just like I understand buying like a really nice set of dice. Like, you know, if you're shelling out.
I like looking at them. Yeah, I like looking at
yeah,
them.
Yeah, but if like if you're shelling out like $50 for a really nice set of like metallic dice, like a really like a collector's item almost.
Yeah.
I totally get that part. But just going up and buying those like $6.99, $7 every TTRPG player knows these dice sets.
Yeah, it comes in the Chessex dice.
Yeah, the Chessex dice. Yeah. If you're just buying more of those, stop. What are you doing? You have enough. Like, you don't need more, you know?
Agreed. I know people are going to be like, oh, but I just like to collect them. Don't tell me what not to collect. We're not saying that.
No, I'm not. I am. I'm telling you to stop collecting.
Oh, okay. Drew is.
Yeah. I'm telling you to not have fun your way. Have fun my way. It drives me up the fucking wall.
Do you think... Why? Why does it drive you up the fucking wall?
I just look around the shop and I see so many things that you could use that money to buy that is more useful for the purposes of D&D or
Drew is not only telling you to have fun his way, but also to spend money his way.
I'm just saying, like, you know,
go buy BattleTech or something.
Buy a $7 Chessex dice set or buy a $7 mini that you can use in your home games, right? Like, it just. You know, you don't need more dice, but you might need some ghouls in your games. No, because you can get more use out of the minis, right?
Oh, so it's a value thing.
Yeah.
Is it a value thing? I guess you aren't going to use the dice every single time.
Yeah, but like, yeah, it's like when I... So for those who don't know, I am on a quest to own all of the D&D... big, like, adult dragon minis that they have out right now. And I have 9 out of 10. The only one I'm missing is the brass one. And so my friends clapped back at me and they were like, well, you know, you're buying all these minis, like, you know, you're buying, like, these dragon
don't
minis.
Hate us on buying dice.
And I was like, what are you going to appreciate more? The fact that I bought another set of shitty $7 dice or that I plopped down a dragon mini that's the exact thing that you're fighting? Like, what, there's a difference in value being brought to the table.
Like, this is the most Asian conversation ever.
I don't understand. You know, like I said, and like,
it's fair.
I see the value of getting like a collector's edition of dice or like, what is their name?
Like, handmade dice. There's the Yanir.
Yanir, yeah. Like, I would love to.
Oh my
to
God.
Have...
I drop money on that.
Yeah.
Again.
Their dice is incredible. I understand the value of that, but like my issue is not against all dice or like,
is it the quality?
It's about quality or it's about rarity. You know,
that's fair.
I have enough cheap dice, and this is not some weird, like, you know, classist, like, bourgeoisie, like shitting on
Daniel
people who don't have the money.
Like, and the dice elites.
Listen, there's nothing wrong with Chessex dice. It's just that if you already own 10 sets of Chessex dice, do you need an 11th? I would say no.
Okay.
Chessex dice are great dice. It's a cool brand, I think. I don't know what they do outside of just making dice. But, like...
I think they make other things. What does Chessex make? They primarily dice.
Yeah.
Oh, but they also make CCGs.
Oh, cool.
They made a CCG called Bane Master, The Adventure.
Oh, okay.
I see why that one's not around anymore. Sky Realms of Jorun.
Yeah, like,
oof.
Again, they're
RPG.
Good quality dice. They look nice, but do you need more of them? It's not a, yeah, I don't understand.
Yeah. Yeah,
I would love some of the really expensive, like, bone dice or gemstone dice.
Like mammoth.
Yeah,
mammoth fossil dice.
It feels like it's probably unethical. So maybe it feels unscientific to take away what few mammoth bones we probably have. But, like, you know.
You know, speaking of dice, actually, I was just reminded of this. I actually excavated a die once.
Oh.
Yeah, it was like 2012 in Jordan, yeah. And I found a bone D6.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah, like a. It was a.
Now, are you sure?
Like,
did you call the director over and was like, "It's a D6, a D6," and then come over?
No, it was straight up a D6. It was straight up a D6.
It wasn't some like rebar that was.
No. Oh God. Why are you
gonna... I should bring this story up every time.
Yeah. No. It was. It was a straight up bone D6. It had all the numbers on it, and like the little dots on it and everything.
That's cool.
And it's actually in like a local museum.
Oh, that's
in,
cool.
In Madaba, Jordan. Do I get credit for it? No. But I found it. My claim to fame is I found this tiny little D6.
I mean, that's really cool, though.
Now. Yeah, it was neat. I was actually reading about the history of dice. And it's not like, honestly, it sounds like we planned for this episode. We did not plan.
No, this
is an unplanned episode. Yeah. We didn't like talk on Discord in advance and be like, you know what? For our No Dice, No Problem recording, we're just going to hate on dice collectors. Or we're just going to hate on people who buy cheap dice. No, that's not it. We went into this completely without a plan, which is something we wanted to try doing. But anyways, back to the, also to clarify, we're not hating on you if you buy cheap dice. It's just not for Drew.
No.
Not for Drew.
I mean, I'm hating a little bit, but again, it's not about, it's not, you know, either way, it's not like, just to reiterate, it's not some bougie thing where it's like, ah, you poor people. That's not what I mean. I just, you know, I have tons of Chessex dice too that I accumulated over the years. It's not about buying them. It's about, do you need more of them? Not, you know, like,
if this is a Daniel and Drew become your Asian dads,
I think it is a very typical tradition for most players and DMs that their first dice are often Chessex dice, and that is a-okay. Mm-hmm. But once you start hitting double digits amounts of sets, I don't think you need to continue.
I'm all for more people buying dice from indie manufacturers.
Yes, I agree.
All
that becomes a bit different. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all for that. Like I think the most I've ever spent on a die was I bought a handmade D20 from a friend of the podcast, Lemmy of Lucky Hand Dice. Mm. I think they're on like an extended hiatus. I bought like a handmade D20 and it was like $25. Mm-hmm. That's the most I've ever spent on a single die. And I know that's not that much. Like we were talking about Yanir's dice, and I'm like, I can't even fathom how much those are.
Yeah, I do the mental calculations of like, okay, you just bought 10 sets of dice. That's like $70 to $80. Or you could buy the mini of the Demon Lord Dweeblex, the ooze one.
Or like a new, you know, save up for a handmade set, or buy some cool RPGs.
I'm just saying. There's better things out there. You can start getting into like Star Wars X-Wing, you know, for that money.
You get into Star Wars
X-Wing. I've been thinking about it. I've really been thinking about getting into some of the Star Wars tabletop games.
You need to have like a community to
play. Yeah, I don't have anyone around me.
Yeah, that's really the barrier.
I mean, the FLGSs have people that play them, but those are strangers and nerds, and I don't want to associate with them. I'm a real hater today.
Yeah, apparently.
Of my own kind.
And we've like put off recording this episode because you were like, oh, I'm worn down. Let's record when we're in a good mood. And we started, you're just like, fuck chess.
Yeah, I have the emotional energy to hate again.
Yeah. So is this episode now called Daniel and Drew Go to War with Chess?
Drew and Daniel hate. The end.
Drew and Daniel hate Chessex. Let's just know.
We can't do that.
Sponsor us. Can you imagine Chessex reaches out and is like, we'd like to sponsor the Asians Represent podcast.
Absolutely.
But we heard that you can't have a double digit number of sets, so we're going to send you 9.
Listen, have you guys heard? It's an incredible value. $6.99 usually in a lot of stores. Chessex gives you a full range of dice. Any particular pattern or color you could possibly think of. There's always tons and tons of choices at the tables. Honestly, a great value. I would highly recommend getting them while you can, because they're running out. They're not running out, but... Listen, I'll flip the switch real fast. Money changes quite easily.
Speaking of which.
Yeah.
Today Yanir just did a restock of dice.
Today?
And today on their website. And these are pretty. These are pretty. Hold up. I'll share my screen for our patrons who are watching. The video, Yanir like hand makes dice. They have like a set called Afterburner.
Good God. It's so much money.
I knew they'd be a lot, but I did not know they would be this much.
But they look so good.
But they are so beautiful. I like the shape of, is that a D8? I think it's a D8. No, that's a...
Hey, listen, this is a moment. Oh. For our listeners, those who aren't on our Patreon, to get in there so you can see exactly what we're seeing. Listen.
So just apparently these are UV reactive blood orange and black.
Okay.
They have UV reactive blood orange and black plumes inside the dice. And there are only two available of the Afterburner. I guess because these are all handmade. Good God. There are so many cool dice. I would, again, we're hating on mass.
Yeah, no, like I said, I don't hate dice.
We don't hate dice. Oh my God. We really switched it up in the matter of like.
Well, it's not switched. It's still consistent. I'm just hating on like overloading yourself with cheap dice.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
You know,
you want your dice to be special.
To be fair, I am also that kind of person who I will pick out like one or two D20s out of like the 20 that I have. And those are the ones I use for the night. And if I roll, like last night.
Do you pre-roll them to test them out?
Absolutely fucking not. It doesn't make any sense. What? No. Do I read their horoscope too? Like what? Like why would I do this? I play the ball where it lies, you know? And last night I picked out one die because I like the look of it. And I rolled 7 natural ones with it that night, last night. Which was really rough.
That's rough.
But I'm loyal, so I didn't change.
I'm just gonna use Kendra. Kendra said that she doesn't have a means of subjecting the resin to like a vacuum.
Mm.
So I don't know if these are perfectly balanced or not. But I'm gonna use the fuck out of them.
Yeah,
because my friend made them, and I'm all for that. Another thing that I just keep looking at these Yanier dice.
Man, the fact that you can get them for monthly payments, it's really tempting right to me.
I gotta pay off my
my dice
installment
debt.
for my polyhedral dice. I was actually doing some research on dice for my like personal Substack. I've decided that I'm gonna write. First of all, I'm still gonna write whatever the fuck I want.
Sure.
But once a month, I'm gonna try to write one TTRPG adjacent thing.
Okay.
And that's like the kind of commitment I've taken on to nobody, just myself.
Sure.
This month, last month obviously I wrote about the fucking D&D summit. This month I'm writing about the first game master. And doing some history into that.
Okay.
And it's like documented in a lot of books that are very expensive or hard to find. But I was talking to a friend of mine, Joe DeSimone, who works for Asmodee. And Joe is telling me, like basically teaching me about the history of D&D.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned this game called, or it's weird the way the word is used, but it's called the Bronstein. Sometimes it's used as like a, it was never really like a fully published game.
Okay.
Sometimes it's referred to as a genre of games. Bronstein. 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 Okay. Meaning brownstone in German. And I was basically, he was telling me about like how in the late sort of 60s and early 70s, around when obviously like D&D emerged, there was this really, really diehard community in the States of wargamers.
Yeah.
Obviously, like Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson were in these communities. And if you look at like the roots of D&D, there are like 7 very influential games to that. First one was published in 1880.
Okay.
And it's called Strategos. And Strategos was actually by Charles A.L. Totten, who was in the United States Army.
Uh-huh.
And it was used to basically like train like commanders. There's another game that was published in 1966 called Modern War in Miniature. And it's by a guy named Michael F. Korn. There's another game from 67 called The Siege of Bodenburg, which is very much a war game.
Sure.
There's Chainmail from 71, a board game called Outdoor Survival in 72, and a game that was actually republished called Dungeon! Those are like six sort of tabletop experiences. And then there was the seventh, and it was called the Bronstein. And the date of publication is typically, you know, 1969, but it was never truly published.
Okay.
And it was invented by a guy named David Wesley, who many people refer to as like the first game master or the person who invented the practice of like tabletop role playing.
Yeah, of having this person who is outside of the game or is a part of it, but outside of the traditional roles.
But even at that time, there were still referees. There were people in war games who were like the umpire.
Yeah.
Right? There are different styles of war games. There's the Kriegsspiel, which has like, which are really, really rule heavy and have like a referee or an umpire. And then there's this tradition of free Kriegsspiel that have very little rules. And essentially, Wesley created this genre or game called the Bronstein. And it's very interesting. And this is adjacent to dice, and I will circle back to dice, but I've been doing research on it for about like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Because I was just trying to figure out how it was played. And like I was going on like forums, finding old interviews of David Wesley, looking at old forum posts that David Wesley made about the Bronstein. And essentially it's kind of like a LARP mixed with a war game.
Mm.
So you could have like over 10 players and everybody gets a pre-generated character. And they're typically like non-military characters. So you only control one person. And the game is set, originally was set in like this like medieval like town called Bronstein, but it could be set anywhere. And Wesley himself has run versions of it at like GaryCon, set in a in the 1950s in a South American country he created called Banania.
It's just about
banana unions. But essentially everybody gets a pre-generated character with like established like objectives and motivations that are required to basically win the scenario. But what's really cool is that multiple people can win, especially if their objectives don't overlap with one another or are require like an alliance. And essentially the entire scenario is tracked on a battle map with like terrain and minis to where people are. And a round is basically you interacting with another person, like socializing. So people would go and like will leave the room to form an alliance, or somebody will form an alliance with somebody, but knowing that they're going to betray them because of their objectives.
This idea sounds so fun, right? Yeah, yeah.
And then what you do is after a predetermined amount of time, this is what I've learned, is you write down your orders for your character and then you hand it in to the referee, the game master.
Yeah.
And the game master is the person who has the power to basically read, interpret, and execute your orders. They do that, the scenario sort of evolves, and then you go back to this sort of social politicking until somebody can win.
Yeah.
And it just sounds so interesting. And at a time when everybody was, you know, measuring out like units and all that stuff, Wesley was basically running these Bronsteins that Dave Arneson got really into.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, obviously we know the history of Dave Arneson from there.
Sure, yeah.
But I've gotten really into the Bronstein and I really want to play one.
I would be so down. I remember at one point our friend Bashir was running an Infinity game that was basically like a Bronstein, right? Where it's you're playing as heads of different factions. And it was all like, I think, a text-based one in a Discord server. And you would input your orders to Bashir. And then Bashir every week would calculate all of those orders. And then, you know, the phases would move forward and things would change across the maps and things like that.
You know? Yeah. And but this one has like, the thing with the Bronstein is that there are like next to no rules.
Oh, it's just pure interpretation of the things that you're doing.
Pure interpretation. Yeah. So it's not like Wesley is rolling dice or anything like that. There are like, from what I've researched, there are no dice involved.
Okay.
And it has like next to no rules and it's all about interaction.
Sure.
That's why it's so close to the LARP. But because there's a referee who's taking orders and executing them on like a table, that's where its wargaming roots come into play.
Yeah.
And you could find a game called The Barons of Bronstein on DriveThruRPG.
Okay.
And it's a TTRPG that was inspired by the Bronstein, but it's very much a TTRPG.
Sure.
But Wesley himself actually wrote a little essay in it called Bronstein in the Middle Ages, and it's actually a setting that you can use.
That's cool.
If you wanted to try to play a Bronstein. But there are like photos from Gary Cons up until like 2022 of him playing it. Mm. And people have noted that like there are no instruction sheets, there are no reference sheets. All they get is a piece of paper with the scenario and like a list of objectives.
Sure, who you are and what your objectives are.
Yeah. And it's just so freeform. And like I am extremely invested in eventually playing one.
I would be very down for this. This would be very cool to do.
Because I think it would be really fun and really chaotic. Like this one that I found, it was from the 2022 Gary Con. It was set in Banania in the 1950s. And the scenario was essentially, I'm reading it off of the Secrets of Blackmore website, that documentary,
mm-hmm.
Because they were actually one of the participants. And the scenario was, it's a national holiday celebrating Banania's liberation from the European colonial oppressors. There will be some sort of procession and carnival, but all is not perfect in the land. The great leader is on a diplomatic trip to the United States, and thus control of the nation is in the hands of his capable and equally corrupt underlings who run the various military branches. The great leader's son is on hand and I think is the referee.
Okay.
But everybody takes the form of like government officials or like labor officials. And I guess the person who was participating played, I think, the head of the banana pickers union.
Okay.
And they had their own like objectives.
The BPU.
The BPU. But it just sounds so interesting. Like there are people, sometimes Bronsteins have involved like props where you can like bribe people of things.
Okay.
Sometimes it's like full on theater of mind. It's just such an interesting idea that like I've never done before. Like I've tried one LARP.
Yeah.
But the idea of writing down orders and then having a referee interpret them is really interesting to me.
And it's such a, you know, despite, you know, I've never known about it until today, but it seems like such an important evolutionary step in what we do all the time now, you know?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I was actually thinking, while you were talking, I was like, oh, if we had the budget and the, like, the ability to, like, the resources required.
We could easily do this at a con.
I was going to say, yes, of course. But it would be cool to do a video series where we play through the evolution of the war game to TTRPG.
Yeah, like that's what I'm writing about. So this is like my piece on the Bronstein is part one.
Yeah.
Part two, I'm actually going to try playing Modern War in miniature.
Yeah.
I was actually going to ask you about it because a PDF of the book is available, like the original rule book.
Uh-huh.
And dude, it just sounds like a TTRPG. In the book, they're actually describing like a scenario. And I'm going to literally, this is on like page 10. And it's like, player, I'm picking up my submachine gun and my grenades and running over to the ditch beside the bridge. I want to keep looking for the American in the houses while I'm running. Judge, there he is again. He's just stuck his head around the corner of the white building around 30 meters in front of you. Here, he's looking around again. Player, am I in the ditch now? Judge, yes, you're about... you've been here for about 2 seconds now. And then it's just like, they just go through like this scenario and it's just like, that's a TTRPG.
That just sounds like D&D.
This book is from 69, 5 years before D&D.
Yeah.
And there are just so many interesting games in the evolution of tabletop role-playing games. There is another game that I've been meaning to play, but I don't think we could ever do it like just you and I, because sure. I think we'd have to live in the exact same, we'd have to do it in person.
Yeah.
But in Dragon Magazine in 1987, first of all, Dragon Magazine, they used to publish like a lot of stuff and it wasn't just D&D. And there was a game that called Clayorama.
Okay.
And it was literally about making your own sort of like creature out of like Play-Doh.
Oh, that's
and
fun.
Fighting.
Hell
and
yeah.
Fighting. But it's really funny. I don't know if I'd ever really like play it on Asians Represent. It's something I'm fascinated about. But Clayorama was actually originally created by David Cook, who is like the primary author of Oriental Adventures.
Ah, what a guy.
So I don't think we could even do that.
Yeah.
But it's something that I, as like an independent creator, am like very curious about. Same thing with just like the old magazines, like Alarums and Excursions, that were basically used to publish old RPGs. Mm-hmm. Like the first, you know how we talked about the Dread Gazebo?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The Dread Gazebo was first published in Alarums and Excursions, which is an amateur press association, like sort of okay. publication.
Yeah.
And this particular one, Alarums and Excursions, had like a ton of really influential game designers actually work on it. Like Robin Laws, who lives in Toronto, had like Feng Shui mm-hmm. and a lot of stuff with Pelgrane Press. Like obviously like Gygax, Robin Laws, Eric Wujek, who did a lot of like Palladium stuff, not good Palladium stuff, but like known names in the industry. Really interesting stuff. So I've been curious about like looking at these old publications and kind of seeing like kind of experiencing them for myself as somebody who was not alive when a lot of these things came out.
Yeah. Like I said, if
and
we
kind
could
of sharing my own experiences,
if we had the resources and we lived near each other, I just think it'd be such a totally cool idea to like play through the history of war games and TTRPGs and like sequentially do episodes where we move to the different games in the chronology and we map out the sort of evolutionary paths and we talk about, okay, this one was developed 2 years later. How does it feel different? Where does it seem to be taking stuff from? You know, I think that'd be such a cool video idea.
There is a really good book on that. It's called Playing at the World by John Peterson. You will never be able to find a physical copy of it for
cheap.
Okay,
yeah.
On Amazon, it's $681 for a paperback.
I'm good. Yeah. I have $7 Chessex dice to buy.
Yeah. but on the dice note, because I did say I would circle back to this, it's really funny because you see Wesley kind of, he's like this like folk hero on many forums.
Okay.
And on one forum, like an old school wargaming RPG forum, he actually said that while I am beating my own drum, I would like to lay claim to having invented polyhedral dice. He was like, I straight up like claim, like I didn't invent the shapes, but I am like the inventor of using them for games. And it's such an interesting claim because it's so baseless, because there are multiple patents for games using polyhedral dice that came out long before he was really active in the space. Like there's this woman named Freda Sieve who had a patent from February 20th, 1963. And it's literally a dice game for tetrahedron die, and it's called Zazz.
Okay.
And it's literally like the patent number is
sounds like a Ouija board demon, but
the patent number is like 3208754, and it's literally a game that uses all of these dice.
Uh-huh.
And like there are images of sets from 1960 with it. Also there was a company before Freda, there was a guy named Yasushi Ishida who had a Japanese patent. I believe from, not sure which year, but I know it was before, I think it was 1960, but it was for a D20 set that was distributed by the Japanese Standards Association in Tokyo. So there are all these people who are patenting and making their own games, but Wesley, very much like other creators at the time who obviously don't have the internet, are basically saying, well, if my community sees me as the inventor of this, I must be the only one.
Sure.
And there are all these really interesting claims to making dice, but Wesley is like one of the big people who was claiming that.
So Wesley's not claiming to have invented them, but rather to invent their usage in games in general?
Yeah.
Okay.
His word is, his exact thing was, I was the first person to use what were then being sold as models of the five regular polyhedra as dice, he says in all caps.
Okay.
It's very weird. It's very weird.
Strange claim. So it's a strangely worded claim, you know?
He strikes me as a very interesting fellow because he also is like, I don't like the term role-playing game because it's too much like theater. He prefers adventure game, despite, you know, what I've just told you was the Bronstein.
Yeah, the Bronstein's just a bunch of acting. Like, I don't, what? Hello?
Yeah, and he strikes me as somebody bitter because he now says we are now stuck with RPG.
What?
Yeah, that's something that he said. Like, you wrote. Although it could be his advanced age, but, you know.
My initial thoughts about Wesley were David Wesley seems quite cool. And that may still be kind of true, but well, it's kind of annoying, too. Like, what? Like, bam, RPGs.
Yeah. Yeah, he, again, like, an interesting fellow. I think he's still alive. He's got to be in his, like, 80s.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, like, the Bronstein was, like, really fascinating to me. And it was, like, a part of sort of my dive into, like, the OSR and, like, the roots of RPGs.
Sure.
And like my fascination with that, because I also just got a new game. The reason why I was in Hamilton yesterday was I was dropping off some copies of Ross Rifles for Nora. They're being sold on Monkey's Paw Games now. And Nora had like a gift for me, and it was a copy of like their new game, Unconquered.
Oh, that's cool looking.
It's
cool.
It's beautiful. Like, I was going to order one myself, but like, dude. Look at that.
That's a great art style.
Isn't that sick? That's like the art style is awesome. I'm gonna do like a full sort of like review of it. But it's really neat. I really love like table, like I love how tables are used in OSR games.
So what's the core concept of the game?
Yeah, so Unconquered is basically supposed to be a lightweight D20 plus D6 system.
Okay.
That really involves like GM ruling. It's very much like the Bronstein sort of free Kriegspiel style. Although I know Wesley is very much against like, I don't do free Kriegspiel. It's my own thing.
Sure.
That seems to be his personality.
Sure, buddy.
But it's essentially, I'm just looking at the Monkey's Paw website because I'm going to get around because I just got this. Even on the back of the book, one player takes on the role of the chronicler and presents a world full of peril and wonder. The others take on the role of travelers who describe how their characters act and react within that world.
Mm.
We play to find out where drama and dice may lead us. And it's this really cool sort of ancient sort of world. And I see this as both like a system and toolkit.
Sure.
And it's like weird it's very much weird fiction in its aesthetic. And I really like it. There's like a piece of art here is like a turtle castle on it. Yeah. And it's just like mapping the Middle Kingdoms. The gods have ruled from the gods may have ruled from tower, may have shaped the outer heavens in their avaricious image. But it was from those Middle Kingdoms that they conscripted soldiers to the universal war, took resources and warred over land and sea and skies, far from the topless golden spires that they claimed as their own. And it's just enough information for you to have an idea of what the world may be, but it is not too much information where you can just add whatever you want to it. And what's really neat is that there are tables for like, hey, this is a D20 table for discoveries or a D20 table for hazards or encounters. And it's just rules light and beautiful. And I also just love the A5 size of RPGs. Like I like this. This is easier to put on a bookshelf.
Can you imagine a turtle that size making the sound? But it's so big. So it's
yeah. And I think another thing that's cool about it is that from what it seems, you can you create your own spells. You create your own spells.
Yeah.
The idea of like using prefixes and suffixes to create like combinations of power. I can't believe you went there.
Sorry. It's just really.
Yeah. Anyways, Nora gave me a copy of this book. I think it's awesome. I want to read through it because
I am doing stuff
for like Wandering Blades. And I really like this size. I honestly really like this
size. It's a good size book. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also love. the cover. That is a almost daring explosion of color. It's unusual, and I like it a lot.
It's gorgeous. I'm really into it, and like, it's so good. I just want to. I don't know if this was on the podcast, but I was talking about how I really want more system agnostic settings.
Sure.
Because I just like reading like fantasy worlds.
Yeah, like world building.
Yeah, I just like to read world building. I was talking about the I was talking about this on the Hero Forge stream that I was on last week.
Yeah.
And I was talking about how I really want more of this stuff. And I mentioned the Atlas of Middle Earth.
Uh-huh.
Which is a really cool book, and it's just like, hey, these are these mountains, and this is how it was built, and it's like the geography and how it interacts with the story.
Sure.
Really interesting
and
stuff.
And by Middle Earth, on, like, are we Tolkien's talking? Books. Yeah, okay,
we're talking about Tolkien's Middle Earth. Really cool stuff. But yeah, talked about the Bronstein, got into dice, mentioned Unconquered. Really excited about this.
Turtle sex noises.
Yeah. Turtle noises, my god. did you want to get into some patron questions?
Sure, yeah, let's do it.
I know we were like, I think one of the things we're going to do, and I think we might want to turn to our patrons to help us with this, is eventually add segments into this show.
Okay.
But for now we just have our mail time segment, and we actually have one question is, I think two of these questions could have been entire episodes. But Eisen asks two. One, Eisen asked, have you seen John Wick 4 yet? If yes, how did you like it? And then as an extension, and this, I don't think it's an extension, but more of like a separate but related question, I guess. What system would you choose if you wanted to run modern / slightly futuristic combat focused storytelling? So I know you haven't seen John Wick 4 yet because you still haven't seen John Wick 3.
Listen.
Since the last episode, I have seen John Wick 4, and I fucking loved it. That was incredible.
The version of it that's in my head is impeccable. The only thing I've seen
in reality, it's also impeccable.
I think you sent me the clip of the Dragon's Breath rounds.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah,
and they did say they were inspired by Hong Kong Bloodbath, the top-down Hotline Miami style.
Oh yeah, game.
Because that's the vibe. I thought John Wick 4 was incredible. I went with like my partner, my brother, and my parents, and my family did not like it.
Really?
They were like, it's too violent.
Oh, well, you know.
And they loved the other John Wicks. They were like, it's too violent. I want more story. And I was like, this is some really interesting world building. Like, they expanded the world even more.
Yeah.
There were like, the action sequences were like really intense, over the top. I absolutely loved it. Nothing wrong with it in my mind. It's also the longest John Wick movie. It's like almost 3 hours.
That's a lot.
But it's all the action is incredible. Like Donnie Yen was super good in that movie. Also Scott Adkins, who we've talked about. I really liked
it. Yeah, what a great,
I know you
what
haven't
a great
seen
film.
It.
Yeah, no, I...
yeah, incredible film.
I but, could... You know. No, you know what? It's time for me to publicly say I have seen it. I watched it the other day. And, you know, I have it burned in my memory. I could tell you every scene back to back.
Yeah. Action scene, action scene, action scene.
Yeah. No, I mean, like... You
know, memory.
Yeah, it scene. Starts off with... John seeing his wife, you know, at the hospital again, and you know he's sad because she's dead. He's burned through his fourth dog so far, you know. And then he has this like really, really homoerotic bath, you know, with Scott Adkins. It's great, you know.
You gotta watch it. You gotta watch it. We're gonna move on from
this.
He
shoots a guy.
He shoots many, many people.
Nope, it's just the same guy. The guy's really resistant.
I mean, you haven't seen John Wick 3. In John Wick 3, they introduced High Table. Obviously, the High Table is like the ruling, the governing organization behind the world of assassins. But High Table enforcers who wear bulletproof like tactical armor. And the weak points are like around the neck.
Yeah.
And so they're like constantly trying to get them around the neck. Really interesting stuff. But... there is a part of Eisen's question that you could answer, and it's is there a system that you would choose to run sort of modern slash slightly futuristic combat focused storytelling?
Dungeons and Dragons, because it's a sandbox toolkit that you can use for everything.
Good God, you really did not come prepared.
No, I don't need to be prepared. This is no, that's no problem.
It's not D&D.
I actually don't know. Jokes aside, I don't know. I think because I've never played a modern TTRPG, except for like Scion Second Edition, which is kind of, but not really.
Yeah.
And I did not enjoy that experience. That's a whole can of worms. But I just haven't really played anything modern or slightly futuristic.
Yeah, I would, if you want John Wick. From like a world perspective, I would recommend Excommunicado. Excommunicado is like an indie game by Adam Vass and slash World Champ Game Co. Super good. It's an indie game, really rules light. Makes use of like clocks, a la like Blades in the Dark. Really like that one. If I were to do the thing with like a John Wick game, is that if Isaac's question is about replicating John Wick. Is that you need to constantly feel in danger, but the main character really needs to be able to keep pushing forward.
Yeah. I would say, despite not knowing really much about systems out there that could do this, from a storytelling perspective, whatever system you need is one that can keep up the pacing. Because if you slow down,
it would have to be a system that gives you momentum.
Yeah. You have to build momentum. You have to be able to keep it. If you get stalled out, it kills that momentum, and it no longer feels like John Wick or any.
Yeah.
You know, it could be Extraction. Great movie, by the way.
Great movie.
I'm excited to see Extraction 2. But like any of those like kinds of games. Oh, you know, it doesn't even have to be like lone wolf, badass guy. It could be a team of people, you know, like a party of players. It still needs to keep up that pacing. If you have a player stall out because they're taking like 5-10 minutes to think of their turn, it's going to kill that vibe, and you're not quite having that anymore.
Yeah, so I would say the game would need to have high lethality.
Yeah.
But it would also have to give the player the ability to manage resources in a way where they can protect themselves from lethal blows, like in John Wick. Mm-hmm. Like John Wick has his bulletproof like suits, right? I would go towards something like Coriolis, like Year Zero, because in Coriolis you can kill somebody in like one shot if you're smart. It is a die pooling system, so your chances of success, especially if you're playing as like a really competent character, are extremely high. And the more like D6s you roll, the higher the chance for like a crit. I would then add in my favorite sort of system from a game called Errant. In Errant, you can parry blows, and it's a similar thing that we're doing in Wandering Blades, where you have like a limited number of resources that you can use to reduce incoming attack rolls. So you could essentially have really lethal attacks, but only the players would have the ability or limited ability to reduce damage or even reduce incoming attacks. I would also go for a system that treats HP not as like your health pool, but as the buffer to you taking serious injury. So when your HP is gone, you are then taking serious injuries that would then have long-lasting effects on you, very much like in the world of John Wick. If you're doing like military shooters, you can even draw on elements from like Delta Green, which has like a system in place for that. But I would just strip out some of the stress mechanic or the mechanic that basically puts you out of action if you see too much awful shit, because John Wick is constantly doing awful shit, so he would be resistant to it. I would honestly combine systems. I would take like maybe some of the modern military stuff from Delta Green. I really like the lethality also of like Coriolis, but also the action economy of Coriolis. But then in Errant, it has a parry mechanic or a guard mechanic that would be really useful in having a player or a group of players keep up their momentum. And strike with lethality, but also maybe prevent themselves from also being taken out very fast. It would still help the game feel dangerous because you would be running out of resources to protect yourself which I think is important, because that resource can be something very narrative. It can be your sort of like John Wick suit. It could be I'm like sitting behind cover and, you know, there's an enemy technical and it's just blowing up the cover in front of me and it's slowly wearing it down. Or even that guard mechanic itself could you narratively represent like being suppressed by enemy fire and limit your ability to take action. I don't think there is like a one game alone. And I know some people might be like, oh, what about feng shui? I think that could be a system that I would use, but I want something that's hyper lethal. So I would lean towards the OSR or like some European games for that.
And like, there may be some, you know, indie game out there that we just don't know about or have not read in depth enough to know anything about that may do it. But it seems that, yeah, a combination of various things might be the best, but that's also probably the most annoying solution, you know, is to have to.
Yeah. There's another RPG called Covert Ops as well.
Oh yeah.
But I think it's, I don't think it will run as fast as what you would want. In line with this, actually, we had another question from Comrade in our Discord server. What movies/video games do you think have had the most intriguing world building, even if the plot was so-so? So we don't have to actually like the movie, but we can like the world building or video game.
John Wick.
John Wick has a really interesting one, especially as the series progresses. You learn more and more about the world of assassins, which I think is very cool.
High School Musical.
The scale of which... that's cool. Which one? High School Musical, the musical, the series, or the original three movies?
The original. I'm an OG fan. Cool.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I honestly think from a world-building perspective... I was actually thinking about this a lot today, like looking at my bookshelf. I honestly think the world of Berserk, the manga Berserk, is very interesting to me. That series is not for everyone; has some very dark themes.
Sure,
but I think it's got like an intriguing world. So much so that I actually bought the world guide.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, another one is Elden Ring. I think Elden Ring has a very interesting world. Because it was, in my first playthrough, it was like very confusing. And I was like, I just want to know more. Like, and you're constantly being fed more information, but in a very organic and also like self-led way. So I really like that.
I'm trying to think of things that I remember... There was the Netflix movie Bright, which I thought the movie itself was fine.
It's just a movie about racism.
Yeah, but I thought that some of the concepts and some of the world building was really interesting. And my biggest gripe with that movie was similar to a lot of other people's, where the movie was fine, but it would have served better if it was a much longer form, like TV series or something, or they could have had the space to like explore some of that. What other things?
I also see Star Wars. I mean, obviously, like, I love Star Wars, and I really like what they've done with sort of the non-movie content, especially around, like, Jedi Fallen Order and the discovery of the Zepho and how in the Darth Vader comics and some of the other Marvel comics, they are diving into other interpretations of the Force and how in, like, Clone Wars, and this also appears in Fallen Order, like, on Dathomir, the Witches of Dathomir. They have literal... Force magic, which I think is very interesting. I was actually talking to someone about this yesterday, about like how I think Star Wars is very fascinating when you dive beyond the movies. Some cool stuff there.
I feel like I wouldn't be able to move past this segment without talking about Arcane.
Of course.
So for those who don't know, Arcane is my favorite. League of Legends is not my favorite thing in the world. I like it.
You love the show.
I love it a lot.
You love the show.
But Arcane is my favorite TV show of all time. And the way that they do so much complicated world building in such a tight and concise amount of time, you know, a lot of it being in ways where I think one of the great things about Arcane is that they presume that their audience is smart enough, you know, to figure certain things out or to find the hidden subtext and things like that in what they're showing you. Which leads to a lot of great moments and surprises and just the way they sort of tease out the world building in a very natural way. You know, they don't have to do these big, long expositions in order to get it out of the way. They do it naturally through just the show. That, you know, the writers for Arcane show you the world. They don't tell you about the world. They just show it absolutely. In action. As opposed to, you know, having to expose and tell you that it's interesting. They just show you what's interesting about it, which is...
On top of that, the animation is really, really beautiful.
So good.
Yeah. I think I might also add... Oh, I literally just lost it. Fuck. I'll come back to it. I'll come back to it later. But, I mean, we could do, again, like I said, we could do a whole episode on, like, what we think is very intriguing world building. Or just beautiful. Like intriguing could mean like, oh, it's complex and thought provoking, but also like, oh, I just want to spend more time here. Like Genshin Impact, I don't think has like a very complex world, but it's a beautiful one.
Yeah.
And I love playing the game just looking around. Yeah. I have really not progressed the main story just because I like exploring in that game.
You know what's another a studio that's a really great example of showing and not telling is Studio Ghibli. Right.
Oh, totally.
Their films are really good at showing you the interesting parts of those worlds, not telling you about them. You know, you just naturally experience it. Not everything has to be explained. And you kind of get lost in that on wonder of those new places and those fantastical things.
And you could love the parts of it. Like you can still love the media they produce without even diving into the world.
Yeah.
Like you can love it to whatever degree you want, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. Like I feel like similar to Arcane and similar to others, it's like the more you invest into it, into that viewing experience, the more you'll get out of it. But even just the most basic bare bones viewing experience of you know, casually having it on, is still a great experience. Like you'll still enjoy that. Right. But the more you dive in, the better, like the more things you'll find, the more you'll notice and whatnot.
Yeah, 100%. I still have fond memories playing League with you.
League's and, a like, terrible game.
But it's a good social experience.
Yeah. No, I shouldn't say it's a terrible game. It's fun.
I don't know. I think the only multiplayer game I've been playing a lot of is honestly Battlefield.
What a great game. Well,
it is now.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah.
It is now. But it still doesn't have the same I don't have the same feelings about it that I do for Battlefield 4.
Now that 7/8 of the lobby aren't running the advances, it's pretty good.
Yeah, everybody's running the RM68 now.
Yeah.
but we have a couple of other not so deep questions, but still very valid. Agatha asks, what's the best flavor of bubble tea? And to combine with this, I'm going to combine this with the last question from Temporal Insanity was, what's your take on boba toppings like milk foam, popping boba, fresh taro? What's your take on boba toppings like milk foam? Oh, right. I pasted that twice into my notes. Yeah. So like, I guess, what's your favorite flavor? And then what are your takes on toppings? I know we say bubble tea. Do you say boba or bubble tea?
I will usually
say... I know like boba's very much like a West Coast thing, and bubble tea is like an East Coast thing.
Well, being from Missouri, I think people just say whatever here. I've noticed both all over the place.
Both.
I usually say bubble tea, personally.
Okay, yeah.
But my personal favorite, my go-to is roasted oolong tea, half ice, 30% sugar. And then no bubbles, no tapioca, but instead grass jelly.
Mm.
It's a great combo. I feel like an old man when I drink it, but it's so good.
So being lactose intolerant,
yeah,
it really depends on if I'm going to be with other people for an extended period of time,
okay,
or if I'm going to be like coming home on my just coming home. And yes, Sarah and I live together, but you know she's used to
at this
point. I really like brown sugar, like brown sugar milk tea. Really like that flavor. So much so that I have like popsicles of it and everything like that. I like having tapioca, but if I go for like more of like a tea, like a green tea or something like that, sure. I really like a fruity flavor. I like grass jelly, but there was this one place in Toronto that made their tapioca balls in-house.
Oh, that's good.
And they had a machine that made them fresh.
Yeah, we have a couple around here that do that.
And those are awesome.
Yeah.
I don't drink a lot of bubble tea. I think I have it maybe once a month. I know you have it a lot.
I have it like 3 times a week at least.
Yeah, I don't have it all that often.
To be fair, I'm also not lactose intolerant.
You can develop lactose intolerance.
Just as a heads up. Okay.
Just as a heads up.
I'll keep that in mind.
You know, in a couple of years, we do an episode, and it's just like Daniel and Drew discuss lactose intolerance, and then
yeah.
refer back to this episode
yeah.
when you're like, ah, ha, 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 I don't.
Yeah, I like. I really like coconut. I really like taro. You know, flavors. Mm. I'm really not much of a green tea person.
I like honeydew.
I've had honeydew. I've never bought my own. I've like tried sips of other people's. And that was pretty good. I would say a major honeydew fan, but what are some others?
Do you like the smoothies and
I've
like
never
slush?
Tried them. I've never tried them. I'm
not into it.
I get brain freeze really easily for whatever reason, and I have some of my teeth are kind of sensitive, and so like I like cold drinks. Ice cold drinks like that, like slushies, I sometimes struggle with.
Would you say that it's better to buy a nice bubble tea than a set of Chessex dice? Because they're basically the same. What's the better value? To circle back.
Milk tea, like bubble tea.
Because you'll buy a drink.
Because it sustains you spiritually, physically, emotionally. Your dice, they do nothing for you.
They can fail you.
They can fail you. Milk tea doesn't fail you
unless you develop lactose intolerant in that exact moment. Like it's why
technically is that you failing bubble tea?
Oh,
I'll put it back on you, Daniel.
That's a good question. I feel like it's my body failing my spirit.
Okay, yeah.
And bubble tea.
Yeah, indomitable spirit, but not but very indomitable body.
You know, we could also say that like maybe bubble tea is attacking me.
Sure,
Attacking me when I'm weak.
Yeah, yeah.
And in this case, I'm always weak.
Yeah. Every time you drink it, it's like, you ruined D&D.
Yeah, you ruined D&D. You don't track HP.
How do you feel about the milk foam? You lactose intolerant?
I've never had it.
It's bad.
I've never
in
had
my
it.
Opinion is
I've
wrong.
Never had it. I really like coconut jelly.
Coconut jelly is really good.
I really like coconut jelly.
I love pudding.
I haven't had milk foam.
I love pudding.
I haven't had pudding on it.
It's great. Love pudding.
I haven't had that. I've had like different like, you know, they do like a brown sugar pearls and like
sure.
like caramel or whatever. I've had those, but I've never had
yeah, those
the
are
foam.
Pretty. The
mostly
foam,
because of lactose intolerance.
The foam is just this weird creamy, slightly bitter thing because it's
right.
cheese, but it's not quite. It's I don't know, man. It's not for me. Maybe it tastes really good in a very specific combination, you know, in the same way that I
right.
would not put herbal jelly or whatever in all drinks. I put it in very specific drinks.
My dad, I just remembered something. My dad tried making grass jelly.
Yeah.
And I was over at my parents' place, and he was like, Daniel, help me with this. And we were trying to make it, and it just looked like tar. And then we put it into a container to let it, like, kind of, you know, solidify a bit. And I came back the following week. I was like, how did it turn out? And my dad was like, I poured it out, and it was a brick. It was like he just made this, like,
okay.
brick, like the food
okay.
that they ate on, like, Snowpiercer. It looked like that, apparently.
That's fun.
Haven't made it at home. What are your thoughts on like canned bubble tea?
I
know I've
good.
Had it on stream a couple of times. I like
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
Like in a pinch. Like there are no bubble tea places that are near me.
Yeah.
I really have to go out of my way to get it.
It's it, for me, it is like saying, oh, do you prefer soda from a soda fountain? Like at a restaurant, like a, you know, or do you prefer a can of soda? I would prefer to just have soda. I don't care. Like yes.
Oh, I mean, but here's the thing though. If we're being like old Asian dads, if I get the soda, I don't get free refills. But if I get it from a fountain, I get free refills.
Oh yeah. Okay. But with milk tea, if I buy those tall can ones, I don't remember the brand. But if I get the tall can ones, they don't have ice in them. And I'm pretty sure they have more than your typical like milk tea in them.
True. So per capita.
I'm just saying.
And the canned ones are typically cheaper too.
Yeah, they are cheaper. They usually, at least around here, they're still expensive for a canned drink. They're like $3 to $4, but they're cheaper than getting the milk tea, like from a milk tea place, right?
So I think the overall theme of this episode is it's okay to be irresponsible with your money to a certain degree. You can buy the Chessex dice if you want. You can get the bubble tea if you want. You could save up for really beautiful handmade dice. My God, I'm still kind of... I've never actually seen the website when it was live. I've always missed all the drops.
Yeah.
This is my first time seeing them. Super cool. Or you can wait and save up for that brass dragon that you want. That's the one you need, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's released yet. I don't remember, but...
Okay. I don't know. I also have a hard time with minis. I have so many that I haven't painted yet. I have
hundreds and hundreds of minis.
And you need to make like a get like a display case or something.
You know, I think the cruelest trick God ever played on mankind is making miniatures so easy to buy but so difficult to paint. Because my brain goes, why?
There are contrast paints now.
Yeah, but like my brain is like, why would I spend hours painting this mini when I could just go get another mini?
Yeah, or what are your thoughts on?
God, I'm chasing the dragon. I'm chasing the dragon.
You really chase the dragon. Or like, what about like pre-painted stuff?
Yeah, those are fine.
Yeah, or do you like having the option of potential? I mean, even with a
pre-painted it just thing, depends on what it is.
Eventually paint it yourself. Yeah.
You know?
Like the big things. I mean, there was that... There are some nice ones. I don't know. 3D printing is really changing the scene. Like, I was just on that Hero Forge stream, and I made the Flame Emperor, the main boss for our home game. And I... you know I'm a very slow painter.
Yes.
But I managed to paint quite a bit of it in that time.
I'm very proud of you.
I'm very proud of myself. But I had like planned a week ahead and I was like, okay, I'm going to use these paints and this is how it's going to look. But yeah, I think when it comes to minis, I don't know if I would go out of my way to buy... If I'm going to buy a mini and if I'm going to paint it, I'm going to buy a really nice one.
Sure.
Like, I don't know if I would buy... I mean, this goes back to the whole thing about, like, Chessex dice, right? The same thing with minis. You get the Reaper minis, really awesome. First of all, I have tons of Reaper minis. Like, the sculpts are pretty good, but you can get, like, a ton. You can get a lot.
Sure, they're Reaper minis. You can get a
for the price
of
like, one GW mini.
Yeah.
Right? But I also love looking at 3D printed minis.
Yeah.
My God. You can...
Oh, like the Etsy shops and things like that.
The Etsy shops where everybody has their own Patreons where they design them. Yeah. It just looks really cool.
But like a fundamental difference between miniatures and dice is that, you know, a dice's value... Like the purpose of dice, which is to roll them, does not change between dice. So the value of them... is found in like rarity, right? You know, or how nice they are. But with miniatures, there's still
the quality of the paint.
There's quality of the paint, but the one of the values in miniatures is that you use them for so many different things. Like, yes, the most basic thing of like they get placed on a table to be played with, it remains the same. But like, it is perfectly valid to be like, I need to field 100 skeletons for this battle. I can buy 100 cheap Reaper minis for, you know,
that's fair.
That like that still has value, you know, as opposed to like I'm gonna pay $1,000 to get 100 GW skeleton warriors, you know, that's insane.
And then commission them all.
Yeah, that's insane. right? But there's a staunch difference in that, you know.
Yeah,
the
role
of the dice and what it's doing for you is so simplistic that that nothing really changes, you know. So
I
think
look at this D20 like it's the One Ring. I'm just like, so beautiful,
you know. But just like I find great value in having all 10 of the metallic and the chromatic dragons, because that way I can anytime throughout the next rest of my life just plop them down and be like, that's exactly what you're fighting, and that's really cool to me.
Yeah,
you know,
and then they could sit on your shelf. I guess dice can also sit on your shelf. I don't know. It's a moral of the story is spend your money however you want. Spend your money however you want.
But preferably just, how I tell you to do it.
Yeah, but preferably how Drew tells you. One Asian dad is like, live your life. And the other Asian dad is like, no.
Live my life.
Live my life. My expectations. My God, that got real. Got real for a second there.
So it is a weird contradiction because I go to Miniature Market here in St. Louis. Shout out to you guys. You guys are awesome.
Sponsor us.
Sponsor us, please. I go there quite often, like usually at least once a week with my friends. I am both the person who tells them not to buy dice, but then I tell them to buy everything else because I have a decent sense of their financials. And they go, oh, but like, I don't have the money. And I'm like, you do. You just have guilt about your money. You know, you deserve this. You've worked hard for this. I do the same thing for you, Daniel, where I'm like, spend your money. You have
and
plenty.
Like,
you're not.
And I'm just like, no.
Your wallet will be fine with a $60 purchase. You'll be okay.
I'm like, but I can wishlist this on Steam and then wait for it to go on sale.
I guess.
Yeah, that is 100% me. You that is a very accurate read on me. And I think that is a character. I think it is a character flaw also, like, you know, it prevents me from really enjoying things too, right?
Yeah.
Like you get that like decision paralysis when it comes to getting things.
I think
so. Yeah, I get it. It's fair.
I think that frugality and wisdom in spending is a character strength. When it develops past that into guilt over choices, that's not good.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know.
That said, if you are going to spend your money, always consider supporting your local game shop, indie creators like, you know, dice makers.
Sure.
Not everyone makes like. There are like boutique dice that are like goals. And then there are folks who make very affordable handmade dice too.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's also interesting. I want to try making my own dice, but I don't have the ability to get proper ventilation here because of the way our loft is set up.
Sure.
It's also the reason why I don't have an airbrush, which I feel like would really help me paint all my minis faster.
Yeah, someday I'll get into airbrushing. I want to get much better at hand painting first.
Yeah. And it's just like repetition and having like a paint station set up. For me, I'm very happy that like my current gaming, not really an, my current gaming ADHD hyperfixation, we should say, is Flesh and Blood.
Yeah.
Very much enjoying it. But I do enjoy that I spent $15 on my deck and I am very happy with it.
Yeah.
It's very cool. I don't know how to, I don't know what it's like to play it remotely because it is, I mean, I know there is an online tool for it, but there is no spell table for Flesh and Blood.
Okay.
But I mean, the game is called Flesh and Blood because they wanted to make a game that people would play in person.
Sure.
It's very much a game that's designed to support like, you know, the LGS.
Yeah.
But I really like it. It's not for everyone. Our mutual friend Oliver and I play it, and we have this like we have an agreement, and it's like we do a quarterly analysis of how much we're enjoying the game.
Uh-huh.
And we're like, are we still enjoying it? Okay, $20. We could spend another $20 to upgrade our favorite deck.
Okay,
so we have like a fair sort of arms race and assessment of where we are in the hobby.
Sure,
which is. Oliver is obviously a lawyer, and you know me being frugal, so it's like it works out perfectly. But I enjoy the game. I think the world is interesting. I like that there are Asian characters. I like that they aren't rolling out a new set every 2 months. And that they're really one of the community is very, very nice because they know that the game needs to grow. And so members of the community are very welcoming to people who are getting into it.
Sure.
Like my LGS is like a very, there are two game stores within equal, like that are equidistant from my home. And one of them is like a magic shop and they're very pretentious. And I only go there occasionally because it's a destination I can walk to and they do sell vintage RPGs.
That's cool.
And they sell like basically miniatures by the sprue as well. Like used stuff.
Oh,
so I sometimes
yeah.
like to go
yeah,
there.
I see.
But their magic stuff is always overpriced. Their yeah, everything there is usually very overpriced. And I went with Emma and Kendra one time and they were very, very rude to them. So I'm like, ugh.
Yeah. When I miniature market doesn't do like magic resales like you know of, of individuals and stuff like that. They just sell, you know, packs and boxes and stuff.
Right.
But they're always really nice about it all, and their prices, because they're also a distributor, you know, with the warehouses and whatnot.
Yeah.
You know, everything's either standard MSRP or you know, they mark it down. It depends on the popularity.
Yeah,
like
I think with the other store that's near me, they're very much a flesh and blood store.
Oh, sure.
And it's in an old apothecary.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So the owner, his wife owned the apothecary and then she closed it down and he took over and has kind of kept the interior. It's a small space, but it still has the apothecary sign outside. And you kind of have to know that it's a game store. But they have a really good, a huge, probably the biggest flesh and blood community in the city,
yeah,
in the GTA, Greater Toronto area. Sorry,
in the Grand Theft Auto, like
in the Grand Theft Auto. And I went in and I asked about flesh and blood because I was like, I was curious. I keep seeing the sign outside. They have this like banner in their window, and he was like, oh yeah, you never played? I was like, yeah, I'm kind of curious. And the owner explained it to me, and he was like, here, and he handed me like two, what is essentially the they call it commoner, but it's like popper. He handed me two decks. He's like, give it a try.
That's cool.
And like every time I've gone in, he's given me a deck. And I'm like, I don't need any more. I'm buying my own stuff now. but they have events called Armory events.
Okay.
And it's essentially like there are two formats. One is called Blitz and one is called Constructed. And Blitz is 40-card deck.
Okay.
And your sideboard is actually your equipment. So the core cool thing about Flesh and Blood is that it's very hero-oriented. So you have a hero. You have a deck of like actions and stuff like and spells and stuff.
Sure.
And then you have equipment. And when you lay out your playmat or whatever, you have your hero and you literally put their weapons next to the hero card.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put your equipment in like head, chest.
Oh, that's fun. Arms, like an RPG.
Like an RPG. Yeah. And then you have a deck here. And what's cool is that in this game, like there are no bad hands because every card can be pitched for resources. There is no mana. So, okay. Like, if I have a card that has zero cost, I can play that card. If it has one cost, I have to pitch a card. Every card has, like, a pitch value, so the amount that you could basically sacrifice it for to give yourself a resource.
Okay.
It has, like, a cost, and then it might have a defense value. So you could actually have a spell that you could just, I'm going to block.
Oh,
and
I see.
And then you basically, so you technically have no bad hands, because you can have a hand that you can attack with or block with.
Uh-huh.
And they have these armory events where they are Blitz or Classic Constructed. Constructed is like hero with equipment as a sideboard and then a 60-card deck.
Yeah.
And then Blitz is hero with, you know, 40-card deck. But what's really neat is that there are two versions of every hero. There is a young version with different art and an adult version. Only differences are that the young versions have less health. And so everybody starts at a different HP. Which is really neat. So like some characters start with, there's a new hero that they announced that's coming out. And it's like another version of an existing one.
Okay.
And she has 16 HP. And the one that I play with has 20 HP. But what's cool is that everybody's talking about how this new card for Prism, the hero, has 16 HP as a way of pre-balancing her because she is already extremely powerful as a spellcaster.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So she's like a glass cannon. And they do this thing in like organized play where they track how many wins a hero has gotten. And if they hit a certain threshold, they put them in living legend status and they retire them from competitive play.
Interesting.
Because they're like too powerful.
Yeah, they're getting too many wins.
They're getting too many wins. And then they'll eventually put out new versions. And so it's really cool how like the community kind of tracks that. But at these Armory events, my local store does it in the Blitz format. It's free to attend. And the company behind Flesh and Blood, we are not sponsored by anyway. Like, this is just my hyper.
Well, we could be.
By the way, for our audience, we could be. they basically ship participating LGSs with Birch every month.
Okay.
So if you attend, you get a free promo card. And then you can play. And at the end of the month, and this is what the store owner told me, they have like special play mats and stuff like that that they can give out to participants. And it's not based on your winning record. It's based on your conduct at the store.
Well, that's nice.
Which I think is really cool.
It's very friendly.
Like, oh, you know what?
Yeah.
So, because I was going as like, a lot of people talk about the game being like, oh, there's a huge barrier to entry because some of the best gear is really expensive. Some of the best cards are really expensive.
But isn't that true of any CCG?
Right? It is. Like, honestly, like most of your spells are going to cost you 15 to 25 cents.
Yeah.
But your equipment can basically, the best or the most essential pieces of gear can cost like $150
yeah.
for one card. But like, you see that in other TCGs.
Yeah.
But at the store, he was like, you don't really need to have, like you can go in with a pre-con and still have fun. And it's not like a tournament or anything. It's just like, hey, we're going to gather, we're going to play. This is the format. Have fun. At the end of the month, we kind of do like a big thing. And I'm going to try to do it.
Yeah.
I'm very curious about it. But yeah, that's my current hyperfixation, and I don't know how we got to talking about
Flesh. We were talking about Boba. And then somehow
how do we go from Boba to...
I don't know.
I don't know. That's no dice, no problem for you.
No, I would say I would actually really like to get into Flesh and Blood. It's just that like I don't think I can order it on their online store from Miniature Market. It's the internet, I can order anything, but like I don't think they're in store. I don't think the retail has it in stock. I'll have to go check again or ask. But I didn't notice it last time I was there.
It's very interesting. There are a lot of videos on how to play. Games are like 25 to 30 minutes.
That's,
like I went to a friend's house like 2 weeks ago and we played like four games and we just like tried out all these different characters.
Yeah, my
it was really cool.
My friend and I played BattleTech Alpha Strike the other day. Which is really fun, first of all. And it was nice because we played a whole game in like an hour and a half. It's a tabletop war game with a little mech warriors. And as opposed to the regular BattleTech game, which is very, very simulationist, very complicated, which, you know, took us like 6 hours to play one game. Yeah. So much faster. It was really nice.
I still have to try that.
Oh, it's really cool. And it's cheap to get into, pretty much.
Yeah, the minis look neat, too. Yeah,
they're really cool.
But yeah, it's just a matter of like how much am I going to go out to actually do this? I also like I like deck building, which is like a part of the fun
for
me.
Sure. Yeah, there's none of that with
this. And I feel good playing Flesh and Blood because A, it's cheap, and B, it's not Magic right now.
Yeah.
Because also, like, that is like a huge mess. Like, first of all, like, fuck WotC. Like, who does that?
Yeah.
Like, who does that? Who sends mercenaries to go get playing cards? Like, who does that? Like, this happened in Games Workshop, and they accidentally sent the wrong mini to somebody. They painted it and leaked it, and GW was like, oh, well, I guess it's out now. Good job. The paint job's great.
It just happens.
Like, it just happens. Like, oh, my God. What a fucking mess. And I understand that it's so hard for people to be fans of D&D and fans of Magic because a mutual friend of ours, there are people who are professional DMs and that is their main source of income.
Yeah.
Like that's how they put food on their table and that's how they put a roof over their head. And so how are you to say, well, you can't play it at all. Like I don't feel morally correct going and being like, no, you can't play this game at all. Because this company is bad. Like, how am I supposed to tell somebody that?
Yeah, right? Because, unfortunately for many, shifting out of WotC, you know, in terms of content creation, would tank their ability to make money. And that's just an unfortunate byproduct of WotC taking up, you know, 90%+ of the space.
And we're not talking about influencers either. We're not talking about influencers. We're talking about people who are like pro DMs.
Yeah.
We're talking about people who, you know, their core audience is looking for their published works that's like based just on D&D.
Yeah.
Although I guess with the, you know, Black Flag and all of that stuff, it might be easier to pivot there. But my heart does go out to like pro DMs who do feel this pressure, but also may not be able to get the audience or the clientele if they pivot to another.
I'm worried about the whole Black Flag thing with Kobold Press, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm worried about that because I feel like people were hyped to jump onto the Black Flag wagon. Yeah. But once WotC put it on Creative Commons, I think everyone went, all right, well, we're back to business as usual. And it's like, oh, okay, you know. All right, for better or for worse, like, you know.
And I feel for people who are in this, you know, like who enjoy like playing Magic the Gathering.
Yeah.
Right? Like or like if you're a game store owner. Like there are so many stores that like they are just kept afloat by the secondary market for Magic.
Sure.
And like as like a fan, like I love playing the game. I love playing the game.
Yeah, it's a fun game.
Play it weekly, right? Just built a new deck that I'm very excited to test out. But I don't feel conflicted about my feelings of WotC because fuck WotC. Like that, what they have done is objectively bad. I know there are complex feelings about like the summit, but the summit was a PR event. In my opinion, it was like very clearly a PR event. And we talked about it on the podcast too. And how there are, of course, understandable reasons why people might go into it thinking it wasn't a PR event. But from my perspective, I went into it knowing it was a PR event, but it was a PR event that I could ask questions at, and I can ask questions unrelated to what they were talking about. But with this OGL thing, with the Pinkertons, like two objectively really bad things, and the Pinkertons is just like, that is a line.
Yeah.
Like I understand the OGL being like, well, that's a business decision that like a C-suite executive kind of wanted. But the Pinkertons, that's just evil.
Yeah, it's not like it was, you know, some amount of like criminal behavior that led to a leak, you know, or a breaking of a contract, or you know, like
dude got sent the wrong thing.
Yeah, like an innocent person just ordered a product online and got sent the wrong thing, and then you know has weirdos show up at his doorstep scaring him and his wife, I believe.
His wife, yeah.
Yeah. And it's just wild to me that that's the steps that a company would take when they could have just spun it as a way to get more publicity for a thing.
Yeah, and I know that there are people who...
Good publicity. I mean, they got publicity no matter what, but...
And there are going to be people who don't care at all. And they're like, cool, now I know what cards are going to be in this Aftermath set, 50 cards that are going to be in this set.
Yeah.
Then there are going to be people who are like, yo, this is bad. Like, there are always going to be people who are on, like, who have different degrees of how much they care. But, like, as people who, like, operate in this space and as people who, like, engage with these products, like, this is, like, a line that Wizards has crossed that is really... There's no way you could say that it's a right thing for them to have done.
Yeah.
It is bad. And I have very complex feelings because it's like Magic is something that I enjoy playing because of the social thing. Like it is the game that got me out of my home. Like, cause I was afraid to leave my home because, you know, COVID and all that. Right. Is like the first thing that I did like in person playing Magic with people.
Yeah.
Me walking to the local shop was a way for me to kind of be outdoors and not feel like scared. And so I have really complex feelings about it because I also care about like my local shops, which is why I'm also glad that like a shop close to me is like a flesh and blood store. So I can go and offer my patronage to them through another game with a company that seems to be much better.
Yeah.
But I think it's just really hard to be like an ethical consumer. And
yeah, it's always difficult trying to
navigate that, especially as people who like are on a podcast and talk about this stuff. And so I guess consider this our statement, because we haven't made a statement. And I know people have asked, like, oh, what do you think about it? I think it's awful. I think what they did is bad. I don't feel like I need to tweet all the time. I don't need to. I don't feel like I need to put my opinion out in the world 240 characters at a time.
Yeah.
But what they did was bad. What they did was objectively awful. And I don't know how they come back from this.
I mean, okay, I do know how
they come back from this. They just keep doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
They just keep doing what they're doing because they're so big that they really can't fail that way. Because the general consumer really isn't going to do anything. They're still going to buy Magic. They're still going to play D&D. And there are some people who have to still play D&D. We've talked about that, and I empathize with that. And there are still stores who aren't just going to drop Magic. They can't afford to. And I get that. And that's why Wizards can just keep on going. Because they know that other people need their products.
Yeah. It's the same way with a lot of GW stuff, right? You know,
yeah,
a lot of stores rely on those products because they sell so well. And what can you do? You know,
yeah, it's really tough. And I think, you know, when we are not like you and I, when we as like human beings are online interacting with other people, like there is a lot of nuance to how people feel about games. And I think it's really important that we do that.
When all of the Activision Blizzard stuff was happening, which...
We were both really excited about Diablo.
Yeah, really excited about Diablo 4, really excited about Overwatch 2 and all that stuff. And that made it very difficult to try to navigate, like, how do I enjoy what was my favorite video game company of all time? How do I enjoy their franchises and IPs that are all ranked within my top 10, you know, you know, that have formed a major part of my life as a gamer, you know, and stuff. How do I suddenly navigate boycotting that? Like, and just getting rid of these things that I have been looking forward to and have enjoyed so often. And like, you know, that always feels conceited when paired up against the very negative experiences that people and harmful experiences that people have suffered at the hands of these corporations, that I whine about, like, but I don't get to play my game, you know? You know, it's, even if it's not nearly as in depth as many others, it still impacts me in a way that I often feel deeply, you know, because I have so many core memories formed around these things, you know.
Yeah, it's the same thing with like D&D Beyond.
Yeah,
you know, D&D Beyond is the tool that we use to run our autism program.
Yeah,
and like I understand and I respect people's calls to like cancel their subscriptions, but I use this tool to help people.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, there are folks who have games that they run with people, that keep them together with people, that tie them to their families, that they use for like educational purposes. It's hard to do that. And not everybody can kind of just like drop things, I guess, which is the point we're saying. Obviously with like Asians Represent content, you'll notice that we aren't making D&D content. We're talking about it, but in the way we've always talked about it. We are critical of the content that they make. And we are always trying to provide tools and content for people who want to try to do better.
Sure.
And that's like always what we've done.
I think perhaps a nice way to say it is we should do less of judging what people consume and more judging on what people produce. Does that make sense? So like if you were consuming a product, you know, whether it's D&D or Magic or whatever, like live your best life, you know, do whatever you got to do.
Yeah. Do no harm to others.
But, you know, if you are able to pivot, if you are producing something, if you're putting something into the jet stream of the economy, you know, of not necessarily financially, but like the cultural aspect, if you are putting out content based on this stuff and you could pivot but you choose not to, you know, are you kind of contributing to some of the issues?
Fair, yeah, you totally know? And I think
I guess
we saw we saw there was a lot of discourse on Twitter about like influencers in this and the idea of like pivoting or the idea of like I'm gonna stay because I know I can make a difference. And I feel like very much caught up in that, right? Having worked for WotC, I've been paid by WotC on several occasions, not to like pump up their products. Yeah. I've never been paid as an influencer, but I've been paid to do things like write. I've been paid to D&D Celebration, where we talked about Asian world building. Like, I've been paid to do that sort of stuff. But as an influencer, I've never been paid by WotC to do anything like that. And if they offered to pay me to like talk about something, I probably wouldn't, because I don't think that aligns with my values. But it's also not my main source of income. So, and I get people who need that money. It's rough. It's a really messy situation for creators to be in.
Yeah, and I guess my point is just more of like, in the privacy of your own home, chase your bliss.
Yeah.
You know, like, as individual consumers, like, you know, your...
Roll your Chessex dice.
Roll your Chessex dice.
Roll your handmade dice.
Crack play whatever open the PHB. Do whatever. You know, like, live your life as best as you can. You know, and then... do what you can to not contribute to the problem.
Yeah, or you know, bring harm to others, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a good place to end. I think that's a good place to end this episode. I did have a thought.
Yeah, what's up?
As a final thought for the episode. I know we were talking about segments. I wonder if we do a segment that's just our monthly hyperfixation. I wonder. I don't know. That's my initial idea. I don't need an answer now, but we will turn to our community.
I'll have to think of
that.
Like,
said,
God, there's got to be some sort of like.
Cool. I can make an overlay for it, and we can have like we can really go all out with this.
Yeah, there's got to be some amount of like a funny intro song to it.
Yeah, we do also have to go and do like the branding and everything. We need to get proper No Dice, No Problem branding and everything like that. Yeah. But that said, if you folks really enjoy No Dice, No Problem, and you enjoy Asians Represent, I know this is something we don't talk about a lot, and it's mostly because I don't like self-promoting. But Drew, you have told me that we need to talk about this more.
Give us the money!
You could say it that way. We do have a Patreon where we post extended clips from No Dice, No Problem. We even have a No Dice, No Problem theme song that is only on the Patreon.
It's that was incredible.
It's very good.
It's so good.
It's very good. It's very good. It was composed, arranged, produced, performed by Drew.
Yeah, it's really good. It's definitely.
I really love it.
It's definitely not a hyperfixation at 2 a.m. that I did for an hour.
Yeah, and so I think it's awesome, and I know people love it. But if you really like No Dice, No Problem, or you really like Asians Represent, and you want to, you know, contribute to the show, if you want to ask questions, if you want to just be a part of our community and learn with us, you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/AZNSrepresent. And if you are a patron for no matter how long, thank you so much for your support. We really appreciate you. We are going to be adding more to the Patreon. We are actually... Drew, this is going to be brand new news to you, but we are going to add a new tier to the Patreon.
Oh yeah.
I was talking to Emma about it yesterday during our long drive to Hamilton, and we came up with the idea of adding a cultural consultation tier to the Patreon. But this isn't going to be right away. We still have to talk about how much it's going to cost, but the pitch is that you basically can get a like an hour of cultural consultation a month. And we're going to work with, you know, within our team and find other cultural consultants and basically...
Yeah, that's not a one-person job.
It's not a one-person job.
Well, and besides, we're most cultural consultancy shouldn't be, you know, because...
Yes.
Representation is not one size fits all.
We're going to be very transparent about, like, what can be covered.
Sure.
And if we match you, if you need a cultural consultant who's, like, outside of the core agents represent team, the money from that sort of month's sort of, like, tier, your subscription, basically 100% will go to that cultural consultant. And so that's why we have to talk about how much it will cost and which cultural consultants we're going to, who agree to work with us and that sort of thing. Because everybody's rates are different, too.
You know,
but
so,
it's something we're looking to add maybe this summer.
So, you know, at the end of the day, to sum it all up, if you support our YouTube, support our Patreon, things like that, you not only support what we do right now in terms of our mission, both for Asians Represent and No Dice, No Problem, and anything else we create, you support our ability to expand and do more with the platform that we have. So give us money. Do it.
Do as Drew says. Instead of for the cost of a set of Chessex dice a month, you can support Asians Represent.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's the TTRPG version of if you just want to buy that $5 Starbucks coffee.
God. There's the end. All right. Well, we'll see you folks next month on No Dice, No Problem. Who knows what we're going to talk about? We never do. But if you want to be involved in the conversation, what Drew and I talk about, you got to be a patron because patrons really steer this show.
Yeah.
That said, we'll see you next month.
Goodbye.
Bye, everyone.
Design Docs started as a podcast about designing a role-playing game. Over the years, it's turned into so much more. It's a show about the challenges of burnout, making money from creative projects, and what goes into bringing a game to life. Come along with Hannah and Evan in a living documentation of the game design process. One review described it as the audio equivalent of taking a hike with a good friend. You can search for Design Doc on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.